So that's probably dealt with the formalities, and I'm now delighted to introduce Annabel Crabb, who will be our facilitator and moderator throughout the conference. Annabel's been a journalist for more than 12 years, covering national politics for 10. She's worked extensively in newspapers, media and, radio and television as a political commentator. Annabel's the author of Losing It, the Inside Story of the Labour Party in Opposition, and the author of the essay Stop at Nothing, The Life and Adventures of Malcolm Turnbull, which won a 2009 Walkley Award. She's been a regular on the ABC Insiders program since its inception in 2001 and hosted her own TV program, Kitchen Cabinet, in 2012. Annabel's particularly interested in new platforms for political reporting, and she's established a regular live Twitter cast of Parliamentary Question Time. So on that note, I'd ask you to join me in welcoming Annabel Crabb.
Well, thank you very much, John. It is a great pleasure to be here. I only wish I could have preceded my appearance with a video on what journalists do, although I understand that that video is still awaiting classification on public health and safety grounds, so we'll have to be patient about that. But welcome to Sydney. It is a perfect, sparkling Sydney day. I believe that has been arranged by the Actuaries Institute. I think that Melinda and Emma are personally responsible for that, so do give them a pat on the back when you see them. I have never been more beautifully prepared for a conference than I have for this one. Nary a spare piece of paper would be flapping on my desk before it was lovingly encased in a plastic pocket by someone from the Actuaries Institute. I love being organised, and it has done the world of good for my natural terror of being in a group within a group of people who can count. This is a very nervous morning for me in that respect. There are hundreds of people who can count in this room, and I'm getting the same slightly nervy feeling that I often get in the federal budget lockup. So keep an eye on me. I'll be the one in the corner panic eating cheese sandwiches and trembling. Although, to be honest, my paranoia on that front vis-a-vis the budget lockup has very much declined in recent years when it's become clear that nobody involved with the federal budget can actually count. I don't feel as lonely as I used to. Hello, Treasury people, anyone? I do look forward to that very intensive audit in the next tax year. Now, I don't know all that much about actuaries, but I do know that you guys tend to squirrel yourselves away in different organisations, and you're busy being the smartest person in the room in your company or organisation. So this is an opportunity for you all to be actuaries together. Sort of, I am actuary, hear me roar type event. So I do hope that you'll all get into the spirit of that. We have a great lineup of people with very interesting points of view, inspirational messages and experiences. I am very much looking forward to it, and I hope you are too. And I hope that you'll all leave this conference with a sense of commonality of purpose and enthusiasm for the profession, for your colleagues. I hope you'll all go out and make a Hollywood movie called Love Actuary. I hope it's all going to be positive and good fun for everyone. Look, I do have a couple of tiny housekeeping matters. We're running several minutes behind schedule, so I'll skate through them. Explore your satchel. It's full of goodies. It has the instructions on how to get into the Wi-Fi. You find that in your satchel. Don't forget to use that. There's presenter feedback forms. Be very nice, obviously, with those. You can submit feedback also by using the web app that John talked you through earlier. And please put your mobile phones on silent. You may use your mobile phones. Just keep them on silent. The mobile number to which you can send SMS questions for our speakers, which will become very relevant in the next session, is 0407 965 495. And yes, it is indeed on the screens behind me. Now, questions can also be delivered through the mics on the floor. I will be merciless with those, so make sure it's super interesting and on topic. We don't want rants about something interesting that happened to you last week. Make sure it's a question for our speakers. Now, one of the aspects of this conference that I've been looking forward to hugely is the opportunity to have a conversation with our keynote speaker today. She is the current Australian of the Year, and I think lifetime honorary title holder for busiest woman in Australia in perpetuity. It's Ita Buttrose. She is a legendary person in my own field, so it's a great pleasure for me to meet with Ita and to talk to her. But also, she has an extraordinary wealth of experience, not just in the publishing industry, but in business more broadly, and of course, more recently, in the truly staggering array of community and public interest activities that she undertakes. She's the national president of the Alzheimer's of Alzheimer's Australia. She's patron of the Macular Degeneration Foundation, and she's vice president emeritus of Arthritis Australia. She has more medals and gongs than I could safely describe here. She was a pioneer of the fight against HIV/AIDS in Australia. She has an OBE, a centenary medal. She was a founding member and former president of Chief Executive Women. I mean, really, I don't need to explain to you why Ita Buttrose is an extraordinary Australian. We're very fortunate to have her here this morning, and I'd love to welcome her to the stage. Now, is everybody able to hear me when I speak from when I'm thus encouched? Everyone, up the bat, someone give me a wave just to confirm. I'd hate to have everyone struggling. Hello.
Thank you very much.
Welcome, Ita.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today. I know there's a lot of interest in this room about...
Talk among yourselves. She's busy.
Disappearing mic syndrome. Right. Okay, I think we can move on. Ita, there's a lot of conversation, I think, these days about leadership. What is leadership? How do you get to be a leader? It's almost a sort of a fetishized form of executive theory at the moment. What's your own theory about where leadership comes from? Is it born or acquired?
I'm never quite sure if leadership is born or acquired. You know, one is always asked that. But I think the person who enjoys leadership actually has something inside of them that says, I think I'd like to go a bit further. I think I'd like to put my hand up. I think I'd like to take a risk. And leadership is enjoyable. I don't think people realise what fun it is to be a leader. It doesn't mean that it doesn't come with responsibilities. It does. But you know, it's quite something to sort of look at the road ahead, see where you might take a company or a project, and then encourage everyone to come with you. And sometimes things don't work. I mean, no one successful that I know of has not had a few detours in their road, whatever level of leadership they're at. But when things don't work, I don't think you say, oh, well, that's it, I'll never take a risk again, because that's what it's all about, how you pick yourself up from something like that. So you make a mistake. You think, okay, that was the wrong thing to do. Sometimes you have to apologise for the mistake, but you pick yourself up and you continue on. So I just think that there's something inside a person who's a leader that makes them want to go the extra mile.
And do you think you can create that? I mean, is it something that you're born with, that sense that that's what you want to do? And I guess a tendency to organise and manage in particular situations. Is it possible for someone who is ambitious to learn how to become a leader?
I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. I think it'll take you right back. You've just got to feel it in yourself. You know, some people feel they are leaders and they put their hands up and get the top job, but they're not. They're really a two or a three. And I think you have to understand what your, not your limitations, but what your abilities are. You see, you have to say, what am I good at? Where can I fit in? And I think someone in a leadership role usually recognises a potential leader. I know there's one or two that have worked for me, and a girl who started with me as a secretary is now the CEO of a major not-for-profit organisation in Australia. And I encouraged her to aim for that. I sort of mentored her all the way through, but I knew from the very beginning that she had leadership potential. And you do recognise it. I mean, we talk a lot about leadership, don't we? But we all know when we see a leader in action. We don't even hesitate. We think, that's a leader. That's not a leader.
So the way that, I mean, we all prize leadership and talk about it a lot, and we equate it with success. Successful leadership equals success as an individual. Is it important for people to evaluate themselves and their abilities and their tendencies and make sure that they wind up in the right place, do you think?
To the best that we can, I mean, but not to the extent that you go hold yourself back. You know, I think it's important not to do that because we are actually the ones who hold ourselves back. We're the ones that put brakes on us. Nobody really stops us from doing anything. We stop ourselves. We think, maybe I won't go forward. And that's very common in women. And I say that deliberately because there's so many men here this morning, but it's not a fault in women that we hold ourselves back. It's something inherent in us. And when you employ a lot of women, and I certainly have, you have to recognise that trait. And sometimes I say to a woman, you just don't realise how good you are. And sometimes you have to say that to women. And you have to understand that they're not as gung-ho at putting themselves forward as men are. And
how many blokes have you had to say that to?
I've often said to men perhaps they should hold back a bit. You know, women are more collaborative. I mean, you know, we can learn from each other. I think a well-run company, a well-run board benefits from having both men and women at the table. It's the skills that we each bring to the table that gives you the diversity that I think companies need.
So one of the hardest things about being a leader, and I know that this will be resonant for lots of people in this room, is the task of delivering bad news. I mean, we're in a room of hundreds of people who regularly deliver bad news. How did you, and you've delivered bad news to some famously combustible people. I don't know how you deliver bad news to Kerry Packer. It's not something that I would necessarily
carefully
want to try. Can you give us some tips about how you do that?
Oh, there's no way to deliver bad news except honestly, I think. It's the only way. I believe in a frank and honest approach at all times. And I have been accused of being too direct, but I don't think you can ever be too direct, quite frankly, and I don't think you can ever be too honest. So if it's not working, you have to say whatever it is. I'm sorry, I've made a mistake, or I'm sorry, this direction we're going is not working. I think we should stop now and pull it back. Now, what I said in the beginning, there's nobody, no successful person has had an easy run to the top. Every single successful person that I know of has made an error along the way. So you have to understand when you go in to say to somebody, even Kerry Packer, which is pretty awesome, I can tell you, having to tell Kerry that something's not working, he will have made some mistakes. I mean, I've shut down magazines for the Packers. We don't talk about them, but, you know, he's given me briefs and I've created things that he said, we're going to pull the plug, we're not doing it. You know, it's not right. Everybody's made a mistake, so you understand. Usually the boss understands. And if you level with him and you tell the truth, it's okay. You just go on.
Can you remember any mistakes that you made and tell us about how you dealt with them?
Quite a few, yes. Well, I think when I was running the Australian Women's Weekly, you've got to remember the Women's Weekly was a weekly, So it sold quite a lot of copies. It sold about 850,000 copies a week, every week. And in the past, it used to have wonderful cartoonists and we'd do caricature covers. That was in the very early days of the magazine. And I was a fairly new editor and I was 33, so I was very young. I was still learning a lot about the business. And I had this great idea, I thought, of putting Margaret Whitlam, the wife of the Prime Minister, on the cover. But she was very interested in the arts, and I can't quite remember what she was doing at the time. But anyway, I got the cartoonist. I said to the cartoonist, I want to do a caricature of Margaret. And so we did her in a ballet tutu and ballet shoes, and she's got her rolled-up scroll that she's going to take to wherever she was off to. And look, it was fun. It wasn't derogatory in any way. I just thought it was a really funny cover. Amusing, eye-catching. Anyway, the readers of the Weekly didn't think so, and the sales dropped 50,000 that week. And the magazine would come out on a Wednesday. We would know by Friday the Consolidated Press, the Packer Company, had a very clever way of doing the figures. They could work out from sales what our ultimate sale would be by Friday. By Friday, it was quite clear that we'd dropped 50,000. And Packer, Kerry had a the executives all had a personal packer phone, you know, and when he wanted you, it just rang. This thing on your desk would just go ring. It didn't matter where you were, you could hear that phone. You'd think, oh my God, what have I done? So I picked it up and he said, come down to my office. And I went down and he said, it hasn't worked. I said, no, it hasn't. I'm very sorry. I said, I won't be doing any more caricatures. Right, make sure you don't. And that was it. Just as well, I was young and very inexperienced. I think that counted.
And you had an experience of having to close down your own business too, which was a difficult thing to do. Can you tell us how you adapted to that and how you made that decision?
Look, I think there are a couple of tough, really tough things one does in management. One is having to retrench staff. I think retrenching staff and firing people is easily the worst job in management. And it isn't something you can give to somebody else to do. You have to do it yourself. And the second one is when you're running a business or a project and you realise it's not working, and not only is it not working, you've run out of puff. And that's something that people running a small business, which my publishing company was, I just thought, I've run out of puff. I'm not enjoying my life anymore and I can't see a light at the end of the tunnel. This was during the recession we had to have. And so I thought, there are other things I want to do in my life, but I'm going to have to let my company go at this point. And so I broke the news to the staff. I called them all together and I told them. And it was extraordinarily hard. And it's extraordinarily hard to do this unemotionally. But, you can't break down and cry because you are the boss. So, but I must say, I think my eyes did water and my mouth did quiver, but I simply told them the truth. I said I wasn't able to continue on anymore, that I had run out of puff and I couldn't see that we could make this work. And then I announced it and I was a media sensation. And was I upset that I was closing my company, said a journalist from Channel 10. And I said, yes, I was, and shut the door. So it was a very hard call because I am a public figure. And so there was more focus on me. It was something I really wanted to do, but it lasted for 6 years. So you think, right, I did it for 6 years. I published a lot of stories that wouldn't have been published in the magazine that was called ITA, the magazine for the woman who wasn't born yesterday, which in other terms means older.
Actually, you've said several times, I did that myself because you have to. You have to deliver bad news yourself. Is it a mistake, you think, that some leaders make to delegate the delivery of bad news? I mean,
yes, you can't do that. You're the leader, you're the boss, the buck stops with you. You must level with the people who work for you. You must. You're responsible for them. And when you shut a business or you retrench somebody, you're interrupting that person's life in the most devastating way. And the least you can do as the boss is talk to them one-on-one.
Tell me a little bit about...
I just want to say about closing my business, because it's an important point to make. I didn't go bankrupt. I paid everybody their entitlements and I paid all my creditors. It's a very important point I want to make. Some people just bail. I didn't bail. I settled everything.
Tell me about adapting to change, because that's an important part of any leader's job, is to make sure that they're alive to the possibility of change, alive to the possibility of evolution. I know some leaders do get wedged into their own habits and patterns by beliefs about their own invincibility. You've made a lot of changes over the course of your life. I wanted you to tell us a little bit about when you arrived at News Limited, because that was a very different culture from the one to which you were accustomed. How did you make that change?
Well, I went from Consolidated Press, from running the Australian Women's Weekly, to News Limited to become editor-in-chief of the Daily and Sunday Telegraphs to Rupert Murdoch. And I was the first woman ever to edit a major metropolitan newspaper in this country. So this was the first time I really realised that perhaps I wasn't welcome, because I'd actually put my hand up and volunteered for a job that was traditionally done by men. So there was an assumption at News Limited that really editing newspapers was a man's job. What would a woman know about it? And they did give me a very tough time. There is no doubt about that. The first 12 months was extraordinarily difficult. And I did, you know, I was left out of meetings, someone forgot to tell me, they used to shut the lift doors in my face. Yes, they'd hiss at me when I walked through the fourth floor. And, you know, these things are quite hurtful, but you have to decide you don't hear them and you're just going to prove yourself all over again. But they didn't. People didn't. And it's a mistake that's so often made in all organisations. They didn't stop to think, why had Rupert Murdoch appointed me? What did he want me as a woman to do to these papers? What he wanted me to do, he wanted me to feminise them. He thought they were too blokey. And he thought they had too much sport. Now, if he'd told all the staff that, my first 12 months there might have been a lot easier, but Rupert's not like that. It's sink or swim. You know, it's up to you. You either make it or you don't make it. And then in the end, I mean, there were a couple of times I did think, what on earth am I doing here? I must have been bonkers. You know, I must be mad. And then you think, no. You know why you're here, Arta. You wanted to be the first woman. Now, so what do you do? You think, well, okay, I'll just have to get on with the job. I'll just have to prove myself again. And that's what you do. You just show them that you actually do know what you're doing. I've been in the business all my life. I started in the media when I was 15. I followed in my father's footsteps. I mean, I've got printer's ink in my veins. I love this business. I love the media. I love being a journalist. And you just think, and I'm not going away. I'm entitled to be here.
We're all human beings, aren't we? And we like to be in groups, we like to have friends, we like to be colleagues. When you're a leader, though, some of that is stripped away, isn't it? I mean, you don't have the same relationship to your co-workers that you used to have when you were one of them. You're now the them. How long does it take to adapt to that? And how long did it take in your case, Ita?
Well, I was 23 when I got my first management job, you see. So from a very early time in my career, I guess I was always perhaps not quite one of the team, and yet you are part of the team because you're leading the team. But look, it's terrific if everybody likes you when you're the leader, but it's really not important. The most important thing when you're the leader is that people respect you. And truly, if they don't respect you, then you really can't run a successful business, in my opinion. Respect's the key word, not friendship.
And how do you establish that early on? Shoot a few generals. What's your preferred technique?
By showing that you... Well, occasionally I wished I could have shot a few generals. No, but by showing that you know what you're doing, by making decisions that are positive and confident, by being fair-minded, by saying thank you to people, by showing them by example that you can dream terrific stories. You know, in our business, you sniff a story. And you think, oh, my God, that's going to be a great story. And you start working on it, or you're briefing a reporter, and they're going out, and you say, come in, tell me, what did they say, what did you find? And then you analyse, you say, what about if we do this, and what if we do that, and what if we do this, and what about photographs? And it starts to loom. I mean, it's fantastic, isn't it? So it's being positive and confident. That's what leadership is all about. And that's how you reassure the people who work for you that you know what you're doing, you know where you're leading people.
Ita, I could keep talking to you all day. It's such a delight to hear your recollections and thoughts. Unfortunately, we do need to move on. So could everyone just give a great round of applause to Ita Buttrose, please?